Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Casey Schwartz was in her sophomore year at Brown University, lamenting to a friend about the impossibility of her plight. She had a 5-page paper due the next day on a book she'd just begun to read. So the friend offered her Adderall, a drug widely prescribed to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And as Schwartz tells us in a recent New York Times article, an hour later, she was in the basement of a library, hunkered down in the absolute quiet room in a state of peerless ecstasy. There's a lot more to Casey Schwartz's story, a 10-year addiction, and she'll tell it this hour on Radio Times, but she's hardly alone in her experience. Abuse of drugs prescribed for ADHD is high among young adults. At colleges and universities, they are used as study aids or party drugs. Later this hour, we'll touch base with Penn student Michaela Gilbert-Laurie to talk about what she's documented on campus. And at the same time, there's also been a surge of ADHD diagnoses over the past 2 decades in the U.S., an increase which is not happening in other countries such as France. Author Alan Schwartz will lend insight into what he's dubbed the ADHD industrial complex. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, here is the number, 888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. So let's welcome our guests. Alan Schwartz is author of the book ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic. Hello, Alan.
Hi, nice to be here.
And Casey Schwartz, no relation, is a journalist and author of In the Mind Fields, Exploring the New Science of Neuropsychoanalysis, and author of the New York Times Magazine article, Generation Adderall. Welcome, Casey.
Hi, May.
So before we pick up on your story, Casey, Alan, in the introduction to your book, you write that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is real, and it, you know, it's also a challenging disorder for those who are diagnosed with it.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, we don't have any magic blood test or brain scan to determine who does and who does not have what medicine has decided to call ADHD. We also don't have that for depression or concussions, for that matter. But that doesn't make the behaviors and the problems that those behaviors cause, usually a child, but sometimes adults, any less real. We call it ADHD in order to try to make sure that we help that person as much as possible. ADHD is defined as severe hyperactivity and or impulsivity. You can't, you know, control yourself from doing impulsive things, and also inattention. It's very difficult to concentrate, to focus on anything for any period of time. And if these behaviors are severe enough to impair your ability to receive an education in a child's case or lead a normal work and home life for an adult, we call that ADHD and try to help them. But the problem is that way too many people, particularly children, are being diagnosed with this disorder. The American Psychiatric Association says it's about 5%. Hmm. Well, 15% of children and 20%, 1 in 5 of American boys nationwide, get diagnosed with this serious brain disorder. And I think it's time that we finally figure out why and try to do better.
And we are going to get into the increasing number of diagnoses in this country in just a little bit in this hour of Radio Times. But first, an awful lot of the prescribed medication that's out there is being diverted for illegal use, and as we mentioned, especially on college campuses. And Casey, again, you started using Adderall at Brown, and the first time this helped you get through that paper.
It did. I remember it. I remember that night so vividly, Mary. It was just, it was unlike any experience I'd had with schoolwork before because it brought so much euphoria. So you become so engrossed in the material, it's like the rest of the world just sort of fades away and you're left alone with, you know, what you're reading, what you're writing, what you're thinking about. And it feels so good initially.
Initially. So when did the breaking point come for you? Because you continued to use Adderall as a study aid.
Yes. I mean, I didn't have a prescription while I was at Brown. So my use of it in college was only sporadic. It wasn't until a year after college that I was prescribed that medication, and then it became a daily thing. And, you know, honestly, the love affair was sort of short-lived. The honeymoon period was short-lived because very quickly you're sort of on this thing and you realize you've made this sort of pact with the devil. That there's such a high cost to the experience of being on this drug that the pure pleasure aspect of it drops away very quickly.
You weren't taking it as quote unquote prescribed before you actually got the prescription. How many pills were you taking at a time?
Oh, you mean at Brown or afterwards?
At Brown, yeah.
Oh, I mean, you know, one. I mean, just whatever was available.
Oh, okay. Because I know at one point you write that you ended up in the ER.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that week, by then it was senior year. And I think the problem was that the whole week had been very sleep deprived. It was finals week at Brown. I was way behind on work, which, by the way, I never would have been before the Adderall entered my life. So I think it was a combination of not getting enough sleep and taking too much Adderall. But this is now more than 10 years later. I don't remember the exact number of pills.
Okay, so you obviously survived your trip to the ER, and you decided, as you said, to get a prescription for Adderall. Why did you decide you needed a prescription? Why did you decide you think you needed to see a doctor to attempt to get a prescription?
Because, you know, I was addicted to this drug by then. This was now more than a year and a half after that panic attack that sent me to the ER. And it was like the addicted brain telling me, you need this. You need this substance in order to sort of soar through your 20s and achieve what you want to achieve.
And it wasn't hard for you to get that prescription.
It was frighteningly easy. I remember this. I was at the UCLA campus in Los Angeles, taking classes in order to be able to apply to graduate school in, ironically, neuroscience and psychology. And I just had this thought. Like I could get a prescription, and I Googled, you know, nearby CBT psychiatrist, had an appointment that same week, walked out of his office in less than an hour with the prescription. And I was never, ever challenged on this prescription again.
Alan, in your research, some doctors, and it's not just psychiatrists, but we're talking GPs and pediatricians, prescribe these drugs easily and perhaps even enthusiastically?
Well, I think that the problem is that the doctors in general don't spend enough time determining whether the person has ADHD or doing a good job in at least, you know, evaluating ADHD. It's not something that you can diagnose properly in one session. You need to understand how long have these behaviors been impairing. Did they exist before the age of 12? That is a requirement. You're supposed to talk to different people in order to confirm whether the person is lying or not. And obviously, Casey was lying about her ADHD. She's one of many. And between you and me, it's the doctor's responsibility to try to at least attempt to determine whether that's the case. But there is such an enthusiasm for recognizing and diagnosing ADHD because the people who really do have it, okay, who are really impaired by these behaviors, the diagnosis and then a prescription can really help, and doctors want to help. However, they are abdicating in general their responsibility to determine the right patients who qualify for the drug, and just, you know, awarding people who say they have, you know, just walk in and say, I have ADHD with a prescription. They don't take the proper time, and it's very irresponsible.
Well, some might say that we're at a place in history now where we're just realizing the extent to which ADHD is present in the population, that it has been historically underdiagnosed.
Well, the thing is that right now, in the official definition of ADHD by the American Psychiatric Association, where they list all the symptoms and they say how to properly diagnose it, they also say that ADHD affects about 5% of children. And okay, let's accept that in good faith. I mean, some people say 2 or 3, some people say 7 or 8, fine. But this is where the experts who define the disorder say that the benchmark should be. You can't argue that ADHD is underdiagnosed. You haven't been able to argue that for years in terms of the mass sort of population of kids. It's been way higher than 5, according to the CDC, for 15, 20 years. And so the folks who say it's underdiagnosed, a lot of them, their professional and, for that matter, economic standing depend on this industry thriving, on lots of kids being diagnosed and lots of kids being medicated. So that's the more cynical view. But also, if you see a child suffering and struggling in school and the parent at wit's end, there's an impulse to try to help with this medication that can help kids sit and concentrate, behave better, and perhaps do well in school. But it is not a diagnostic tool. You can't say, well, maybe he has ADHD. Let's try this Vyvanse and see if it helps. Because, as Casey has described, it can help anybody, not just ADHD people, anybody sit still, concentrate, and at least think that they are performing better. You know, a doctor who says, let's give Tommy this Adderall and see if it helps, he might as well be saying, well, let's give him these platform shoes, see if he gets taller. And then when he gets taller, they're like, oh, well, he must have been short in the first place. It's preposterous the way it's being handled.
Casey Schwartz, how did you finally kick your addiction?
It took till I was 30. And what happened was I had been doing, so I'd been in the midst of trying to finish my first book. And it was actually a disaster. It was so muddled and just lacking totally clarity. And it got canceled by its first publisher. This was sort of this big crisis that happened to me in 2013. And I thought that I had sort of sabotaged myself because of all the Adderall use sort of muddling my very ability to think clearly. And this wonderful editor sort of stepped forward and said, you know, we'll take it if you'll do a rewrite. And that was such a crucial day and period of time and moment for me, because I just remember thinking, I've been handed this second chance to do what I really want to do, and I cannot squander this one. And that was the very beginning of the end of the Adderall.
What did it take for you to walk away from that drug physically and mentally? We've got about 30 seconds before the break.
just willpower at that point, and just knowing the costs outweighed the benefits so vastly.
And as a writing, where does slow and careful thinking, in your words, fit into your work now?
It's so much easier to do without being on speed all day.
All right, we're talking about ADHD, medicines to treat it, and also the prevalence of ADHD drugs being used without prescription for studying and also partying on college campuses. After the break, we'll be joined by Michaela Gilbert-Laurie, a senior at Penn. She's written an article called A Bitter Pill to Swallow, Inside Penn's Adderall Obsession. And also we've got Casey Schwartz with us. She's written about her story in the New York Times Magazine. And also Alan Schwartz has written ADHD Nation. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this hour we're looking at medicine used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, its use and misuse, especially among young adults. Alan Schwartz is author of ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic. Casey Schwartz, no relation, is a journalist who's written about her own addiction and recovery, along with the drug, involving the drug, rather, Adderall. She started using it while at Brown University. And Michaela Gilbert-Laurie is a senior at the University of Pennsylvania and managing editor for 34th Street Magazine. Gilbert-Laurie has published an article called A Bitter Pill to Swallow, Inside Penn's Adderall Obsession. And we welcome you now to Radio Times, Michaela.
Thank you so much for having me.
So again, we'll state that the illicit stimulant use is found on college campuses across the country, of course, not just at Penn. But Michaela, give us a sense from your research of how widespread stimulant abuse is among your peers.
Sure. So there are studies that indicate that Adderall abuse is about 20, it happens about in amongst 20% of students, which seems like a very conservative estimate when you talk to actual Penn students. Most of the people I spoke to gave me estimates from ranging from 40 to 70%. Hmm. So the 20% estimate is certainly really low. What's interesting to me is whether the 20% number or the 40% number or the 70% number is accurate, the perception of alcohol abuse is so, it's so prevalent. And because it's a drug that really inspires the attitude of, well, other people are taking it, so it's fine for me to take it as well. It's really the perception that matters almost more than the reality.
And is it, is the mindset also not just it's fine, but it's necessary to take it in order to keep up?
Absolutely. I think there are certain social circles where you would just be putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage by not getting to that even playing field. So if you're in a class that's graded on a curve particularly and everyone is taking Adderall to study for it, you're really just putting yourself behind by not taking it.
You write that in some ways a 20 milligram tablet of Adderall should be our mascot. It's an emblem, the perfect expression of our academic and social anxieties, the work hard, play hard wonder drug. Let's talk about the use of Adderall as a party drug. So why and how are our fellow students at Penn using it? What have you observed?
So people use it as a party drug in two different ways. Some people take it as a pill just to be able to party longer. So especially if you're going to a day party and you're going to be drinking all day and all night, it just keeps you up. It keeps you up longer. And some people claim it helps them black out less. The other way people take it is by crushing up and snorting it. People refer to it as baby cocaine, and understandably, it has a lot of the same effects that cocaine does. So the thing is, when you snort it, it dissolves in your bloodstream in a really different way than it would if it were dissolving in your digestive tract, and it's obviously not supposed to dissolve that way. So it can have really dangerous effects. It can spike your blood pressure. It can cause myocardial infarctions when it's taken with alcohol. So it's used as a party drug. It's particularly dangerous, but it's also particularly common because especially at Penn, there's not just a competitive social pressure to take the drug academically, but we also have this attitude that you have to keep up socially. So if you're not partying as hard as your friends, then you're not doing it right.
Michaela, when you were talking to your peers, did you find that there is an awareness of the stress this can put on your body?
Absolutely. Everyone I spoke to, no one likes the come down from Adderall. It can cause like anxiety. It depresses your appetite. So people get shaky. People get all kinds of sort of withdrawal effects from coming down from the drug. People don't enjoy that, but the sense I got was the people who take Adderall consistently just sort of deal with it because it's not worth losing what they see as their competitive advantage. And when you're at sort of the level that a lot of these people are at, when you're competing for, you know, X number of investment banking jobs, or you're competing for one of the only A's in a highly curved class, people know that slight advantages yield disproportionate rewards. So it's not worth giving up that slight edge, even if it means staying having to sleep for the next 2 days because your body just can't respond. Like your body just can't deal with 80 milligrams of Adderall.
Is it hard to get a hold of Adderall?
No, it's remarkably easy to get a hold of Adderall. Almost everyone I spoke to said they sought it out and were able to find it in the same day. There are studies I think that say like 60% of college students are offered Adderall directly at some point in their college career. It's slightly harder to get than alcohol, but easier to get than any other drug.
When I visited my daughter's campus recently, I was struck by the posters and information all over the place, really, about preventing sexual assault. But I didn't see anything about drug use. In your work, Michaela, have you come across visible efforts on campus to educate students about the abuse or misuse of drugs like Adderall?
There are some efforts. We have an office of drug, I don't know the exact name of it, some office of drug abuse prevention that has posters around campus that say things like, you don't need drugs to make you smarter. You're smart enough. But there's not an overwhelming effort. There's not an acknowledgement of the problem, first of all, and there's also not, there's not the same kind of effort to prevent the use of stimulant abuse that there is to, say, prevent even like binge drinking. There are seminars during freshman orientation where they teach you about how to handle alcohol and how to figure out what your tolerance is and how to avoid the risks associated with binge drinking. They don't really have that for stimulant abuse yet, and it might be because it's still sort of new, but it also, I think, could be that people are afraid if they talk about it, they'll give people ideas. Like, no one wants to suggest that there is a drug out there that can make you work better, because I think a lot of people worry that talking to freshmen about it is just going to make them seek it out.
Michaela, one more question before we let you go. You wrote, maybe the real moral question isn't about the pills at all. Maybe the drugs are just a side effect of a larger cultural phenomenon. What do you mean there?
I think the problem with Adderall goes so beyond drug abuse. I think it's an ethical problem about distributed justice. The question really becomes, is it okay for some people to have this leg up for strictly financial, like due to strictly financial circumstances? So it's the same question as, is it okay that some people get tutored for their SAT? And it's the same question as, is it okay that some people get disproportionately advantaged entering the workforce when they went to a private university? It's those kinds of questions coupled with this cultural phenomenon. It's sort of the race to nowhere thing, where people are pressured from such a young age to be the best, and we're sort of taught that there are only X number of spots at the top and that we're all competing for them. And so it becomes this sort of cutthroat world where we'll do anything to succeed because we don't see another option. And you see that at Penn in so many ways. You see this sort of hunger to compete and to garner those advantages that are going to get what we think, that are going to get us to what we think we want. But the thing is, like, you get there and you realize it's sort of empty because the high-paying job, you know, only shows you how many people are richer than you. Like, the big houses only going to show you how many people have bigger houses. So it's a symptom of this sort of pervasive cultural problem where we just want more and more and more, and we want it faster, and we want it now.
Yeah.
And there's nothing really there.
Michaela Gilbert-Laurie, it was really good to have you join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Michaela Gilbert-Laurie is a senior at Penn, managing editor for 34th Street Magazine, and author of the article, A Bitter Pill to Swallow. Well, Casey Schwartz, does much of what Michaela just said ring true?
It does. It was so interesting listening to her describing what's going on at Penn, because I think when I was at Brown, this was 2000 to 2004, you know, it was growing, but it wasn't, I don't think, where things are now. So, you know, those numbers would have been much smaller. And I think also Brown has a slightly different culture. Like, it's sort of purposefully, I think, less, you're the whole idea of sort of the cutthroat competition and needing to have a leg up socially and all these things. I didn't really feel that way about Brown and about being at school there. But yes, I think that everything that Michaela just said, I definitely could feel was in the works even a decade ago.
Yeah. Well, Alan Schwartz, and again, this scenario I'm sure has played out on campuses across the country. It's something along the lines of what Michaela described. You talked to students at Vanderbilt for ADHD Nation. What did you hear from them?
Well, virtually the same things. And the one thing that really disturbed me was that when the people at the newspaper wrote an article, not unlike Michaela, and wanted to talk with the administration completely downplayed the issue. They said that, oh, well, you know, it's only about 3%, our surveys show it's only about 3% of kids. And that's the problem, is that the grown-ups here refuse to acknowledge that this is an issue. We talk about how the word that Michaela used was new, and that's fine, because when you're 2021, most things are. But college students have been misusing amphetamine since 19... I mean, there were the first article about the college students misusing amphetamine was in 1937 in Time magazine. And this has been going on for so long. A lot of the college administrators today took Dexedrine in college. They know what's going on, and they refuse to acknowledge it because, A, it's not as much perhaps of an issue as binge drinking. And also, if the kids do better and get better jobs and get into Harvard Law School more often, frankly, it makes the school look better. So there's this willful ignorance. I mean, I don't want to characterize the drugs as sort of magic pills where take it and you get smarter. You don't get smarter. You're just able to concentrate longer and put up with stuff that you really don't wouldn't have otherwise wanted to deal with. It does not increase your cognitive abilities. It does not even increase functional memory. Yeah. But it lets you stay up all night and study.
Alan, now, I'm just going to jump in for a moment to do a station ID. Alan Schwartz is author of ADHD Nation. Casey Schwartz is with us as well. She's written about her addiction and recovery from the use of Adderall in a New York Times Magazine article called Generation Adderall. So, Alan, you were saying that Adderall does not deserve its reputation as a smart drug. Before we get to the calls, and we've got a lot of calls coming in here on this subject, what are some of the answers? What do in your opinion, administrations need to start doing?
Well, I think administrations just need to educate students a little bit better. That's not going to solve the problem by any means.
Sure.
But they need to address the issue, and they need to acknowledge what's going on and make it a part of the freshman orientation. But I got to tell you, a lot of the kids who end up at Penn, and I went to Penn, they all show up knowing what Adderall is. They know what Adderall has done for either them or some of their high school classmates. People pretend as if, oh, well, you know, it's a college thing and it doesn't happen in high schools. Do you realize there was a Family Ties episode in 1983?
No.
Where Alex P. Keaton misused amphetamine to study? I mean, this is no secret. And to me, it's the grown-ups who are failing the kids because we are not making sure that they know what they're messing with. And Casey's article should be required reading for everybody who goes to college. Frankly, they should have me come and talk if you really want to know, because it has to be discussed. And if it isn't, and when kids get addicted, and when some kids die, it's the blood is on the adults' hands. It's not the kids' fault. They don't want to do this. They feel like they have to.
We'll get to the story of Kyle Craig in just a moment. But first, let's go to Matt in Havertown. You are live on Radio Times, Matt.
Yes, I just wanted to say that, 20 years ago, I dealt with this same issue with my son. And it really is tragic. Some of what I've seen has happened to some of his friends that struggle with addiction, that, you know, I knew then it was going to be an issue because really for some of these kids, these pills that they give them for ADHD is not the answer. I read a book, I forget what it was called, and changed my son's diet. And one of the things I realized was, you know, when he was in fourth grade, that bowl of Captain Crunch he was eating first thing in the morning may not have been the best decision on my part. So there are other avenues to pursue, and it makes me sad to hear that there's still a lot of that going on because we're so far past when it all started.
Matt,
and,
thanks.
The gentleman's right when he says, you know, the parents really need to stand up a little bit and ask a lot of questions, which is what I did. And you do meet some resistance, but, you know, that's your son or daughter. You make the decision. You have to help them make the decision if they're older. And don't be afraid to question. Don't believe that just because a doctor or a school administrator especially tells you there's an issue with your child, they really don't know much more than you do. So you need to step in and question everything.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times, Matt. Thanks so much. And Alan Schwartz, he brings up an interesting point, and Casey Schwartz, you as well. If you're a parent and your pediatrician says, well, I think this is something that you should do for your child, or the teacher says, you know, he has or she has all the signs of ADHD, it can be really hard to question that. You feel like you might be perhaps harming your child if you question the sentiments of people who, you know, who are professionals.
Well, you have to do that. And a lot of pediatricians, not all by any means, but a lot of pediatricians have had absolutely no training in the evaluation and medication of ADHD. Frankly, it is illegal in many states for a teacher to even use the acronym ADHD in you know, talking about a child because
really?
They're not a medical professional. Yeah, because for too long in the 70s and 80s, teachers were found to be kind of pressuring parents into, I love teachers, by the way, but pressuring parents into having the troublemaker child medicated for ADHD. The first congressional hearing on this was in 1970. That's how long this has been going on. But getting back to what can parents do? They need to require that the doctor slow down in terms of the evaluation. Any doctor who offers Adderall or Vyvanse or Concerta for a child in the first session is basically committing malpractice, okay? And because the thing is that, yes, the kid is hyperactive. Yes, the attention span and the impulsivity are causing lots of problems. I'm not saying ignore the child's problems, but not all that coughs is bronchitis, and not all that is inattentive is these things. You have to look at, I hear the music. You have to look at anxiety. It might be anxiety. It might be bullying. It might be bad diet.
Right.
It might be all sorts of things.
We're going to pick up on that in just a moment. Alan Schwartz is with us, author of ADHD Nation. Also, Casey Schwartz, no relation, journalist and author of In the Mind Field. This is Radio Times. We're looking at ADHD. More in just a moment. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're talking about abuse of prescription drugs like Adderall and other medicines used to treat ADHD on college campuses and elsewhere among young adults. Casey Schwartz is journalist and author of In the Mind Field, Exploring the New Science of Neuropsychoanalysis. And Alan Schwartz is author of ADHD Nation. And Alan, just for a moment, I wanted to pick up on something that you mentioned before we headed into the break. We do not have physicians on this particular panel. And you did say that, you know, if ADHD, if I heard you correctly, is diagnosed in the first session, well, it shouldn't be diagnosed in the first session with a medical professional. A psychiatrist might disagree with that and say, well, I have the criteria and I'm a professional and I really think this child should be put on a course of medication. How do you respond
well, look,
to that?
I'm not a physician, and I am not doling out medical advice, the legal disclaimer we all should put out there.
Sure.
But no, it is not acceptable for you use the word psychiatrist, so I don't want to seem like I'm just harping on them. No, because in order to understand where the behaviors come from, as we said before the break, that the hyperactivity and impulsivity and inattention that will show up and the doctor will learn about in that session can derive from many different things. It can be from anxiety. It can be from the breakup of a family. It could be from the jamming together of two families. I mean, if dad's girlfriend and her 4-year-old crazy kid are living now down the hall, a kid might, become inattentive in school or might act out. Bad diet, bad exercise. I'm not saying that ADHD doesn't exist. It's only, though, if you rule out all of those other things that ADHD becomes an appropriate diagnosis. You need to talk to the teacher. You need to talk to teachers from beyond this year. You need to really take a strong clinical history of what might be going on with this child. And you cannot do it in one session. And I will debate anybody, including the president of the APA, on that note. No problem.
All right. Casey Schwartz, were there some underlying issues of your own that led you to try the Adderall when you were at Brown? And now that you've moved away from that and your addiction to Adderall, if so, how are you handling those issues?
That's an interesting question. It sort of harkens back to what Michaela was describing earlier, which is just this feeling of, you know, wanting to be sort of excellent and always wanting to be at the top and sort of doing my academic best and feeling a pressure to do that. So I think that's largely why the pill appealed to me so much when it first came into my life. It felt like, you know, it was sort of this magic bullet that could help me do those things. But actually, the thing is that the longer this addiction went on, the more obvious it became that it was having the exact opposite effect. And it was actually – it became a huge handicap. And this – to go back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation, there actually are studies now suggesting that Adderall doesn't help, and it can even sort of slightly hurt certain people who take it in terms of – its quote-unquote smart drug capabilities.
Okay, so to be clear, this is illicit use of Adderall, not prescribed.
Oh, off-label use.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, like some of those studies actually come from Penn, from Martha Farah's lab, saying that, you know, in all these different tests of intellectual achievement, creativity, memory, many other things, she basically saw small to no improvement, and she thinks that higher performing people may perform worse on the drug.
Casey Schwartz, in your opinion then, is it necessary, as Michaela had said earlier, Michaela Gilbert-Laurie, to kind of attack the culture of this, the culture of extraordinary pressure and competition on many college campuses?
That just feels like such a huge task. I'm not sure how one concretely might go about that realistically. I think it might be more helpful to talk about the fact that Adderall may not actually help very much, personally.
And Alan Schwartz, as you said earlier, it doesn't deserve its reputation as a smart drug.
No, but I would caution us from suggesting that it has – I mean, I understand Martha's work and Casey's absolutely right in citing it. However, a lot of these types of studies that show limited to no effect, that's on average, and it's in a relatively short-term study. But I'm confident that if we looked at sort of the quintiles that did perform a little bit better in this short-term study, they know that they performed better, and they are more likely to do it again. And so while, yeah, on average, it's maybe zero, okay? The people for whom it does help are going to continue doing it and get habituated and get addicted sometimes, not always. I mean, that's part of the problem here, is that in many ways, Adderall and Vyvanse and Concerta and its other siblings are not dangerous enough, because if they were more dangerous, we wouldn't have our heads in the sand. Okay, and a few lawmakers' kids would have died, and they would have done something about it. But it's found this little sweet spot where the adults can kind of ignore it and the kids can kind of do it and everyone just sort of doesn't worry about it.
Well, Alan, just, you know, we're heading toward the top of the hour here, but I did want to talk briefly about the story of Kyle Craig.
Kyle Craig was a freshman and sophomore at Vanderbilt. And by the way, his situation is one that can happen anywhere. We're not picking on Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
But he was a typical kid who felt that he had to try and then continue using Adderall in order to compete. He went to a doctor, and the doctor just, you know, accepted his claims of ADHD. And he admitted that he just, you know, didn't have it. He just needed to compete with the other kids. And he got horribly addicted. And when you really misuse the drug, the chances that it creates real psychiatric issues, up to and including hallucinations and psychosis and severe depression. He was unfortunately one of those kids, and he ultimately did kill himself. That is a pretty rare situation.
Yeah.
I think what we need to do is we need to look at situations like that, not on whether the suicide was completed. It's whether the person achieved the level of despair and resignation in terms of control of their life and own emotions to have them even consider doing something like that. There are a lot more kids out there messed up on the drug than there are who kill themselves and make themselves fodder for radio shows.
And again, very quickly, we're talking about competition, the sense of competition this young man felt, the need to compete. And once again, as I asked Casey earlier, is it something, in part at least, about attacking this particular culture, reaching for the bar that's impossibly high, that prompts kids to use these drugs or misuse them?
I got to tell you, that sounds awfully Sisyphean at this point. I mean, no, but I'm not saying it's unreasonable to ask. Well, no, but that's just such a pervasive issue that I think that if we want reform in this area and fewer kids misusing the drugs, what we need to do is we need to have the medical providers who prescribe the drugs improperly to way too many kids. I mean, they prescribe it properly to some kids, and God bless them. Okay, and there are a lot of kids with legitimate ADHD who benefit from these medications and need to have them. But we are so scattershot right now in terms of making sure that those are the kids identified and the other kids don't get it. And so it starts with the medical providers. It starts with educating kids that, yeah, you see a lot of kids seeming as if they do better on it, but you are playing Russian roulette. And they need to know. I mean, for example, like a lot of people don't know. Remember the guy in Philadelphia who drove his Jeep through the fence at the Philadelphia airport?
I do not.
And started driving around? Everyone remember that? That was a kid who started misusing amphetamine in college and got so wired that he went completely psychotic and thought that he was being chased by special agents. And that's why he drove through the fence and tried to take off in his Jeep. People need to know what this stuff can do.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of calls and comments coming in. Let me get to some of the comments. Scott Manioc says public schools, in his opinion, are so bad that some parents who can't afford private schools sign their child up for IEP, which means the kids need to be diagnosed with a disability to get more attention from teachers. Comment from Terry. If you only knew how terribly this affects people with ADD/ADHD, how difficult it becomes to get meds because so many doctors knee jerk when they hear the word Adderall. We all suffer because some, as Terry puts it, twits, decide to take Adderall when they don't need it and then blame Big Pharma for their personal abuse of the drug. Alan Schwartz, what's your reaction to that, to Terry's comment?
Well, I like the word twits. I think that's really fascinating. I think that, first of all, I understand that some select people might feel as if, well, their doctor was averse and a little too careful. However, in the aggregate, clearly not enough doctors are being too careful, okay? Doctors in general are way too happy to make the diagnosis and write the prescription. And so, yeah, I mean, the whole blaming Big Pharma, I mean, boy, that's a whole separate ball of wax. But that's one of the problems here is that there are a lot of people who legitimately need the drug, who have been legitimately diagnosed and need the medication, or at least it appears as if they need the medication. And we are doing those people a disservice by diluting the diagnosis and the need for the prescription beyond recognition. And so nobody knows who has and who doesn't have ADHD anymore because we're doing such a terrible job. And so the people who really should have been benefiting from this don't get the respect that they deserve from society because everyone's like, oh, well, you know, everyone misuses Adderall. That's not fair to them either.
Casey Schwartz, what is your take?
Yes. I mean, I would echo that idea that Alan just spoke to. It's clear that while that might be true in certain cases, on average, we don't have a problem with doctors being overly cautious with this medication.
Alan Schwartz, let's just talk briefly about the diagnosis itself. You wrote that the American Psychiatric Association has gradually loosened the official criteria for diagnoses to include symptoms like makes careless mistakes, often has difficulty waiting his or her turn. Why is this?
There is such an enthusiasm. Well, because, look, there are two reasons that are very separate. First of all, the more cynical, okay, is that so many of the people who run the American Psychiatric Association and who are involved with the definition and delineation of ADHD have been completely bought off by the pharmaceutical companies. They are the ones who get the $100,000, even higher grants. They're the ones who are given 10, 100, sometimes more than $1 million to conduct the studies and to give talks and to devise all the literature.
You say the APA receives significant funding from drug companies. Is that correct? Oh,
absolutely. But then again, so do a lot of other organizations like that. So it's not like they are particularly evil. Now, they have been asleep at the switch. But the thing is that, so yes, you have a lot of the people in charge whose, as I said, professional and economic standing depend on a thriving ADHD business. I'm sorry. That's the more cynical way of looking at it. The more naive is that doctors want to help. They see a possibility that if somebody is struggling, they think that this pill might help, and sometimes it will. But in terms of the loosening of the diagnosis, they keep trying to make it easier for doctors to diagnose and prescribe. It used to be that a child had to be impaired by these symptoms, okay? But in 2013, they decided to change that word from impairment to it has to interfere.
So, Alan, we only have a couple more minutes, and Casey Schwartz, Alan Schwartz, Casey Schwartz, no relation. A couple more minutes. Let's talk about how ADHD medication is marketed along the lines of what you were just talking about, Alan. And Casey, I want your reaction to this.
Well, the drugs are marketed in two ways. One, to doctors and in their sort of professional journals and meetings, and then also to the general public. There isn't as much direct-to-consumer advertising as there used to be, but the drugs are marketed as, literally, there's a woman smiling, and it says, hey, because of Vyvanse, I could organize my family's photo albums. And they're also marketed as, if you don't take this drug, your license is going to get revoked, and you're going to get divorced, and all these terrible things. So the marketing has really gone so overboard in ways that the FDA just hasn't been able to get caught up with.
And actually, Mary, it's funny because there's this new slew of it in the New York City subway system.
Really?
Aimed specifically at adults, saying, is it possible that you're one of these undiagnosed cases of adult ADHD? And what's sort of funny to me about that is just that, is there any time of day when you're more likely to feel, oh, I must be one of those, than when you're riding on the subway to and from work? It's like the perfect place to put these
ads. Yeah, well, pharma knows what it's doing. Yeah. Pharma knows what it's doing.
Well, and Alan, you say that the adult market is the next burgeoning market for ADHD medication or diagnoses and medication?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a study done, and I hate that phrase, okay, but a lot of people who were bought off by pharma came up with the figure that 4.4% of American adults have ADHD, and they say only 1% to 2% have been diagnosed, and so we need to, we need to double that. And hey, if you're out there struggling with ADHD as an adult, we shouldn't just dismiss you.
Sure.
Okay. But there is just such an effort now to make sure, some people call it, it's a good news diagnosis. If you get the diagnosis, you can soar, you can achieve your dreams. I mean, it's just icky. And, the whole Shire thing on the subway, of course, they're not, Shire sells Vyvanse, but they're just selling the diagnosis. And they know that if you sell the diagnosis, the prescriptions will follow.
Casey Schwartz, you've got about 10 seconds. Any final thoughts from you?
Not really. thank you, May.
Your story, we really appreciate you sharing your personal life with us here for this hour of Radio Times. Casey Schwartz, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, May.
Casey is a journalist and author of In the Mind Fields, Exploring the New Science of Neuropsychoanalysis. And Alan Schwartz, our thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
Alan Schwartz is author of ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic. And as always, if you have a moment, check out our Facebook page, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening to Radio Times.